When I was a little boy, and I mean like little boy, I lived in Miami, and my dad bought me a bow and arrow with those little rubber tip suction cup tips on the end of the arrows. You know, some of you remember those. I don't think they even sell those anymore. And so I immediately went out in the backyard and shot my sister. And the arrow did not stick, and I was so disappointed, and she was disappointed too, but for an entirely different reason. And so she began to cry, and my dad came out in the backyard. I could, you know, you have pictures that stay with you forever. And he came out and he took the arrow, and he said he was going to spank me with the arrow, not stab me with the arrow, no emails. He was going to spank me with the arrows, because that back in the day, that's what you did. That's why I turned out to be such a fine, responsible citizen. So anyway, so he began literally to chase me with this arrow, and I thought, well, my mom's in the house. Surely there's mercy in the house. And I ran in the house, no mercy for mom, through the living room, into their bedroom, into their bathroom, dead end, nowhere to go. And the only way to literally cover my rear was to sit down. And I did, but the lid was up. And immediately my knees were to my chin, and I was folded up in the toilet, stuck. This is, I'm not making this up. I'm in church, okay? And church is, I'm a lot of church. So anyway, so I'm stuck, and I can see I'm low, towering over me is my dad with the arrow, and he burst out laughing, uncontrollable laughter, and I escaped that particular spanking with the arrow. But I learned something. My behavior was forever modified. Do not shoot your sister with the bow and arrow. I learned that very important lesson. And then throughout my childhood, this will be surprising, throughout my childhood, I had other behavioral modification lessons. They went through middle school and high school and all the way through college. And this is something we've all experienced. In fact, we are all really, really good at monitoring and modifying our behavior, aren't we? Because, I mean, when you went to that new job, they said, this is how we do it here. When you went to college and joined a fraternity, they said, this is how we do it here. Sorority, this is how we do it here. We don't do that. We don't dress this way. We don't use that language. So throughout life, we've learned that in order to be successful, we monitor and we modify our behavior. And we're pretty good at it. But then every once in a while, from out of who knows where, and I don't know where this, we don't know where this comes from, do we? Out of nowhere, it seems, or out of somewhere for sure, we say and we do the dumbest things. And we even say sometimes, I don't know where that came from. And the people around us are going, we know where it came from, right? That thing in your, that does this. Okay, we know where it came from. And what we're saying when we say, I don't know where it came from is, that's not me. I don't think that way. I don't feel that way. Where did that come from? So where does all that stuff come from? That's what we're going to talk about today. We're in part 5, the final episode of our series, Guardrails. If you've been with us for a while, you know why we call the series Guardrails. But if not, a guardrail, as you already know, is a system designed to keep vehicles from straying into dangerous or off-limit areas. Guardrails are never placed in the danger zone. Guardrails are always placed in the what? The safety zone. That's right. And that's why we get in trouble sometimes when we talk about the kind of guardrails we're going to talk about. Guardrails are designed on the highway to do two things, primarily to direct us and protect us. But as we've said throughout this series, the highway is not the only place we need guardrails in our lives. We need some financial guardrails. We need some moral guardrails. We need relational guardrails. We need guardrails in our marriage. Some of you need guardrails in terms of how you parent your children, because you were parented in such a way that you don't ever want to do what your parents did, but you have a tendency to veer off in the very same direction that your father, how your father disciplined you, or your mother disciplined or didn't discipline you. So sometimes even as parents, we need guardrails. And specifically when we talk about a guardrail outside the context of the highway or curbs or bridges, a guardrail is actually a personal standard of behavior that becomes a matter of conscience. It's a personal standard of behavior. That is, I've decided for me, not for you and you not for me. I've decided for me there are certain things that once I begin veering in these directions, something's going to go off in my conscience and say, you're getting a little bit too close to the side of the road. Not when I'm in the danger zone, because guardrails aren't in the danger zone. When I'm in the safety zone, but moving in a direction that may be dangerous for me personally or the people that I love. So the point of a guardrail is to light up our conscience before we hurt ourselves, to light up our conscience before we hurt other people, to begin feeling uneasy early before it's too late. So today, as we wrap up this series, I want to talk about what I think is the most important guardrail of all for all of us to establish. I want to talk about how to guard your heart. Solomon, who was considered in the ancient times to be the wisest person that ever lived. Some people still think he's the wisest person that ever lived. He wrote the book of Proverbs. He wrote Song of Solomon. He wrote Ecclesiastes that were included in the Hebrew Bible that then just got wrapped around and strapped onto our New Testament documents. And Solomon wrote about a lot of things. He wrote about money, relationships, marriage, all kinds of relationships, work, what happens after a person dies and what we can expect in the future, the meaninglessness of life, the hope in life. He wrote about everything. But in the book of Proverbs, he says essentially, hey, all that stuff I wrote about, it's really important, but there's one thing I don't want you to miss. If you forget everything else I said, if you ever had that conversation with one of your parents or maybe with one of your kids, if you forget everything else I said, here's what Solomon says. If you forget everything else I said, above all else, guard your heart. Guard your heart. I've said a lot of important things, but above everything I've said, guard your heart. Well, Solomon, why is that such a big deal? And he says this, because or for everything, 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 everything you do flows from it. Now, what if that's true? And this isn't even like a religious thought. I mean, what if that's true? What if everything we do erupts from or flows from something that's on the inside of us? What if everything we do originates within? Well, if that's the case, then whatever within is, and obviously it's not our physical heart, but it comes from within us somewhere. If that's the case, then learning to guard that within part because it impacts the without part would be super important. So the question is, what does it look like? What does it look like to begin to guard your heart? So one day, 1,000 years after Solomon wrote that, 1,000 years later, Jesus is with his guys, and they're doing their Jesus and their disciples thing, healing people and teaching and preaching. And wherever Jesus went, perhaps you know this, wherever Jesus went, there was a cloud that followed him of religious leaders, Pharisees, teachers of the law, scribes, priests, high priests, all kinds of people. And they would be on the outside of the crowd because their goal was to trick Jesus and to drive a wedge between he and the crowd so that once they could isolate him, they could arrest him. Because as long as there was a crowd, the religious leaders weren't allowed. But every once in a while, they would work their way to the front of the line and say, Jesus, we have a question for you. And their questions were always trick questions, which makes reading the Gospels fascinating. So on one of these particular days, a couple of guys made their way to the front of the crowd and they said, Jesus, we have a question for you. Why do your disciples, the folks that follow you most closely, why do your disciples break the tradition of the elders? I'll explain what that is in just a minute. Why don't they wash their hands before they eat? To which we read that and go, certainly, Jesus, your parents taught you to wash your hands before that you eat. And certainly your disciples' parents taught them to wash their hands before they eat. So what's up with this wash your hands before you eat? So what they were referring to is this. In the Old Testament law, the high priest and the priest and anybody that was to do sacred work before God had to do certain ceremonial washings to make sure they were always ready to do God's work. Because you did not want to touch something unclean and then do God's work. So your hands had to constantly be clean. Well, over time, and so this was a tradition they had. It was a law they had for the religious leaders, but then they turned it into a tradition for everybody, and they imposed on everybody else this sort of guardrail rule that said everybody needs to do these ceremonial washings so they don't accidentally touch something unclean, like something dead or blood or something that was off limits to ancient Jewish people, touch that and then touch food and put the food in their mouth. So they said everybody needs to do these washings. Well, the law didn't teach that. The law said that was just for the priest, the high priest, and certain folks that worked at the temple. The priest and high priest came along and said, no, all the Jews had to do it. So this was a tradition, not actually a law. So over time, the temple leaders elevated the importance of this tradition to that of a law. So Jesus wasn't breaking one of the Ten Commandments or one of the laws. He just wasn't paying attention to one of their traditions because they made it up. And Jesus chuckled and thought to himself, are you crazy to bring this up? And he said to them, Jesus replied, okay, well, let me ask you a question. Why do you actually break the command of God for the sake of your tradition? You're accusing me of breaking a tradition that's not even a command of God. You actually break a command of God in order to protect one of your man-made traditions. One example of this, and basically these would be sort of their own guardrails they had established, but in establishing a guardrail, they're actually violating the command of God. I can illustrate it this way. Imagine a father saying to his teenage daughter, do not speak to your mom disrespectfully. Do not speak to your mom disrespectfully. And the teenage daughter goes, okay. In fact, I heard that guardrail series. I think I'm going to set up a guardrail that will keep me from speaking to mom disrespectfully. Oh, good. What's that? I'm not going to speak to her at all. That way I won't accidentally speak to her disrespectfully. To which the dad says, but that is being disrespectful. You've set up a rule to keep from breaking a rule that's actually a violation of the rule. Did you follow that? All the dads follow that, I know. Okay, of teenage daughters. So this is what they had done. They had come up with a rule because, see, the teenage daughter doesn't even really want to talk to her mom, okay? So I'm going to set up a rule to keep me from breaking a rule to get to do what I want to anyway. So that's what this group had done. There were some things in the law that Moses had given that they didn't want to keep. They didn't want to do that part of the law. So they came up with their own rules that would keep them from having to obey God's law. So basically, they were breaking the actual law to preserve their traditions. And so Jesus tells them exactly what he's talking about. He said, for God said, and then he names one of the top 10. This is like in the, you know, the table of contents for the entire law. And God said, honor your father and your mother, which they all knew that law. But you say that if anyone declares that what might have been used to help their father or mother is devoted to God, they are not to honor their father and their mother with it. Now, his audience knew exactly what he was talking about. We read that and think, we have no idea what you're talking about. So here's what he was talking about. That these religious leaders had come up with a tradition that allowed them to violate the law to honor your father and their mother. And here's what their tradition was. It's pretty crafty. They had this rule that you could just verbally dedicate or give away everything you owned. So a moderately wealthy person, very wealthy person, could just say, I dedicate all my belongings to the temple. Everything I own, I now give to the temple. But according to this tradition, you could use what you own to support you and your immediate family as long as you lived. So what they did is they came up with a rule that kept them from being generous, because anytime somebody said, ask them to do something, they could say, no giving while I'm living. There's no giving while I'm living. There's no giving while I'm living because I've already given everything to the temple. Now God allows me to use all this wealth to support me and my immediate family. And so what would happen is their aging parents would come to them needing help. Imagine in that culture. Imagine, I mean, you think about how quickly we lose our eyesight. I told Sandra years ago, you know, I have terrible, terrible eyesight. And I said, you know, I would have starved by now. I could be neither a hunter or a gatherer. I would not know who the enemy is and who the friends are. And I have to get so close to the fruit to finally pick because my eyes are. So imagine living in a world where, you know, after a certain age, you can barely see. So parents needed the support of their children just like they do now. And so these religious leaders, their parents would come to them asking for support. Get this. And they would say to their parents, oh, mom, oh, dad, I would love to help you out, but I can't give you anything because I've already dedicated it to God. So Jesus, he is having none of that. He says, thus you nullify the word of God for the sake of your stupid, I added that word, your stupid tradition, you hypocrites. You've come up with a rule to keep that allows you to get by with not obeying the overt will of God. Honor your father and your mother. Now, whenever Jesus would end his conversation with you hypocrites, that meant this conversation is over, okay? And all the people in the crowd would cheer because Jesus just made the religious leaders look kind of crazy, and there wasn't a whole lot of mercy and a grace coming from them toward the people anyway. So the religious leaders shrink back into the crowd, and they shrink back into the crowd kind of going, who came up with that stupid question? I don't know what might have. You said it was a good question, because they would just humiliate themselves constantly in front of the crowd. So then Jesus, you should read the Gospels, it's fascinating. Okay, so then Jesus turns, you know, to the crowd, because all the, you know, the religious leaders have walked off for the time being. He says to the crowd, listen to me, I want to make sure you understand what just happened between me and the religious leaders. I want to make sure you're clear. Jesus called the crowd to him and said, listen and understand. And then they're all leaning in. He says, okay, just want to make this clear. What goes into someone's mouth does not defile them. Because the issue was touching unclean things, touching food and putting it in your mouth. And they would, you know, they didn't understand germs, obviously, but they had all these cleanliness rules. And it was a big deal what you put in your mouth. And of course, you know, Jewish people, even today, there are just certain things they don't eat. And that was the case back then. So Jesus says, I want you to understand something. When you put the wrong thing in your mouth, it does not defile you. And defile you has to do with a person's relationship with God. In other words, what you put in your mouth does not make you unworthy to God. What you put in your mouth does not put you at odds with God. Now, this was a brand new idea, brand new idea. But here's the thing to remember when you read the Gospels. Jesus was a hinge between the Old Covenant and the New Covenant, between the Old Testament and the New Testament. Jesus had come to unleash something completely new in the world, but he was born, as Paul says, under the law. So he is a law-abiding Jew who is about to introduce something better than the law, that supersedes the law, that makes the law of Moses obsolete, like your iPhone 5. You know, it was awesome during the day, but hey, you know, it's obsolete. There's nothing wrong with it then, but something better has come along. Jesus had come along to introduce something better in the world. So throughout his ministry, this is so important, throughout his ministry, he would drop breadcrumbs to let people know something new is coming, something new is coming, something new is coming, something new is coming. So this was a shift. The law, the ancient law of Moses, God's contract with Israel, was all about staying clean. It was all vertical. Is God happy? Is God happy? Is God happy? Let's keep God happy. It was all eye to the sky. And Jesus says, that day is coming to an end. What you put in your mouth is no longer going to defile you in the presence of God. But what comes out of your mouth is what defiles you. It's like, okay, wait. So it's what's in here that comes out of here that's the problem. It's not what I put in here is the problem. It's what's already in there that comes out of here that's the problem. To which they're thinking, but wait a minute, what comes out of here are words, and that affects people. So you're telling me that God is more bothered, that God is more bothered by how my words impact people than how my actions or my words might directly impact God? That God is more bothered by what we say than what we eat? Now this is new territory, and the conversation ends. So they walk off. So Jesus started with a big crowd and the Pharisees and leaders. Now he's down to the crowd. Now it's down to him and his guys. They're walking off. And Peter comes up to Jesus. He says, hey, of course, I understood exactly what you were saying. But some of the other guys are a little confused. So could you go over that one more time and maybe just go a little slow? I got it, Jesus, I got it. But for the other guys, would you, because this is so new. I mean, if we understand you correctly, I mean, this is big news. And Jesus turns to his guys, and I think he was having fun with them, honestly. He said this, he said, are you still so dull? Are you still so dumb? Are you not able to follow me? And they're like, follow me. So Jesus gathers his 12. Now he's got the small group. And he says, okay. And he says, I'm going to go slow. I want to make sure you understand this. So I'm going to go slow. You tell me if I'm going too fast for you guys. Okay. Don't you see that whatever enters the mouth goes into the stomach? Everybody following me? Like, yeah. And then out of the body. Everybody following me? That's like, Jesus, we know that. Duh. He's like, I just want to make sure, you know, I was not going too fast for you, okay? Into the mouth, into the stomach, out of the body. Can they kind of chuckle? And then Jesus gets serious. And he says, but the things that come out of a person's mouth come from the heart. The things that come out of a person's mouth come from inside the person. And he uses the heart as sort of this figure of speech. The things that come out of a person's mouth, they come from the heart. And now he gets real serious. And that's what defiles them. And it's these things, these that defile a person. The thing that puts a person at odds with God is not what goes in, it's what comes out. The thing that puts a person at odds with God is not what they eat, but how their words affect the people that God loves, that words that offend others offend God. I'm telling you, as obvious as that may be to some of us, this was brand new territory. This was a complete reversal of everything they had been brought up to believe, because they had been brought up to believe that priority number one is keep God happy. And you keep God happy by doing certain things, not doing certain things. I mean, if other people aren't happy, too bad. Got to keep God happy. And then Jesus says this. You ready? If you've been daydreaming or doing something else at home, okay, don't miss this part. This is super important. For, says Jesus, for out of the heart come evil thoughts. Murder, that's an activity. Adultery, that's an activity. Sexual immorality, that's an activity. Theft, false testimony, slander. He says, from the heart comes all these things that defile a person. Why do these defile people? Because they hurt people. And when you hurt people God loves, you hurt God. And when you offend people that God loves, you offend God. And when you do things that harms other people, it offends God. That's what defiles a person in God's presence. It's not what goes in. It's what comes out and how it affects other people. These, he said, these behaviors that impact other people, these horizontal behaviors, these are what defile a person. This is what makes God a little bit upset. So they're going, wait, so mistreating other people puts us at odds with God? not breaking dietary laws and cleanliness laws? Jesus says, no, I want to make sure you know. But eating with unwashed hands does not defile them. Now again, maybe this is the first time you've heard this, or maybe you wish you'd grown up in a church that believed this, because this is what Jesus taught. And it was at odds with the Old Testament, and it was at odds with their Jewish leaders who were doing their best to follow the law of Moses. If what harms people offends God, and the behavior that harms people that is sourced in our hearts, so if what offends God is what offends people, and what offends people comes from our hearts, then we need to guard our hearts. In other words, according to Jesus, our behavior will eventually mirror our hearts. And our hearts will eventually show up in our behavior. But our behavior eventually mirrors our hearts. And what's in our hearts eventually flows out into our behavior. Now, the interesting thing is, you already know this. You may have not have thought of it in these terms, but you've seen this. You've seen this in your life. You've seen this in the lives of other people, right? I mean, do you know anybody that blew up a career because of what came out of here? Do you know anybody that burned down a marriage with their tongue? Do you know anybody that alienated their children because of how they behaved in the home? Do you know anybody that destroyed a marriage because of how they behaved outside the home? And some of these very people, in fact, some of us are some of those very people, aren't we? And we look back and think, what was that? Who was I? Where in the world did that come from? So, as we kind of wrap up this series, I want to spend our last few minutes talking about four emotions that should ding your conscience. That when you think these thoughts or feel these feelings, when you think these thoughts or feel these feelings, when your mind starts to go down this trail, it should bother you. It should light up your conscience. It should remind you, or it should inform you, that you have some work to do. Because if you do not deal with what's on the inside, it eventually makes its way to the outside. And not only do you hurt you, and not only do you hurt perhaps the people you love the most, it's offensive to God. And it's not offensive to God because he's so sensitive and, you know, so emotional. It's offensive to God because God loves the people you hurt. And God loves you. And when you love someone, you don't want to see them hurt themselves. And when you love someone, you don't want them to be hurt by someone else. So these should tip you off. You can think of it this way. These are like internal tensions that deserve, in fact, I think they demand our attention. So here they are, four emotions, guardrails for the heart: guilt, anger, greed, and jealousy. Guilt, anger, greed, and jealousy. Guilt, anger, greed, and jealousy. When you identify these, because greed you don't even feel, but you may identify it. When you feel it or identify it, you have work to do. There is something in you that has the potential to create chaos outside of you. And our tendency, right? Our tendency is to wait until we've said something, to wait until we've done something. That's like putting the guardrail in the danger zone. We want to put the guardrail in the safety zone, which means we start paying attention as soon as there is an internal tension. Guilt says, I owe you. I owe you an apology. I owe you something because I took something from you and you don't know about it. Or maybe you do, but I'm too proud to admit it. Guilt says, I owe you. It leads to walls, inauthenticity, right? Dishonesty. Guilt leads to secret keeping. It leads to creating distance. What's wrong? Nothing. What's wrong? Nothing. What's wrong? Nothing. What's wrong? Nothing. How long am I going to do this the rest of our marriage? What's wrong? Nothing. What's wrong? Nothing. What's wrong? Nothing. Well, there's something wrong. I don't want to tell you because I'm carrying something, and it seeps into our words and it makes its way into our relationships. Anger says, you owe me because you hurt me. You took something from me. You either pay me back or I pay you back. Now, the problem with anger, and we all know this, is that anger leaks. Anger is not stationary. Anger is mobile. Anger leaks into our other relationships. Another way of saying it is that anger is never isolated to the relation of origin. That anger is never isolated to the relationship of origin. In other words, you were hurt as a kid. You were hurt in that last job. You were hurt by that last girl. You were hurt when he broke up and the way he broke up and the way you found out. And you're carrying that anger, as Don Henley says, and it'll eat you up inside, because it's true. But anger says that you owe me, and until you pay me back, I'm going to hold this over you. And I'm going to hold it over anyone who reminds me of you. And long after you're out of my life, I'm still going to hold other people hostage to what you took from me. Greed says, I owe me. It's what we talked about last week. So what is greed? Greed is the assumption that it's all for my consumption. That's right. Greed is the assumption it's all for my consumption. So greed is, I owe me, and I know you're in need, and I know there's these people that are struggling, and I know that the church has asked, and I know that the folks at work are raising money for, and as much as my heart goes out to them, my money does not. And as much as I feel sorry for what they're going through, I don't feel so sorry that I'm going to write a check. Because I owe me. And oh yeah, it's heartbreaking, but when it comes to actually writing that check, when it comes to actually giving that money, there's something I can't justify it. I hope no one ever discovers how much I have and what I did with what I had as opposed to helping someone else. But it's like, I can't do that. It becomes a filter for all of our decisions. You know what else happens with greed? And this is mainly a guy thing, I think, and maybe it's just because I have heard stories that relate primarily to men when it comes to this. Men, if we're not careful because we like stuff, men, the people in our families, the people closest to us, will feel like they're competing with our stuff. They'll feel like the car is actually more important than her or him. That making sure that stays, you know, buttoned up and tightened up and, you know, locked up and insured, you know, don't go in there or I'm going to let you look, but kids don't touch. After a while, listen, when your children feel like they're competing with your stuff, you have a greed problem. You do. You say, no, I just like nice stuff. No, you like nice stuff. When you like nice stuff more than you like your children or you like other people, that's an issue. That should bother you. That's like you bumped up against a guardrail. Uh-oh, something needs to be done about that. Come on. We don't want the people we love feeling like they're competing with something we own that eventually we're going to leave behind and they're going to sell it. And they're not going to get a good price for it because they don't care. Because it's just a bad memory. Right? Jealousy, life owes me. Somebody got what I deserve. She got who I deserve. He got what I deserved. I was in line for the promotion. They didn't even talk to me. Boom, put her right in. You got somebody else what got what I deserve. Life owes me. And now you don't like them. And now it's almost impossible to be nice to them. You know what else happens with jealousy? This is the ickiest, ickiest, ickiest thing. And when this rises up in me, I mean, I just speak it out loud because I think it is the worst, grossest, I don't know another word I can use in public. This is the ist stuff I can think of. It's when I find myself secretly celebrating someone else's loss or failure. Is there anything worse than that? Is there anything lower than that? If that is in you and if that is in me, that should set off alarm bells in our conscience because it will eventually leak. So when you feel it, when you see it, you got to address it. When you feel it, when you see it, when you notice it, when somebody else notices it in you, and of course you say, oh, no, 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 no. But then you walk away going, oh, yes, 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 yes. I think yes. In fact, I can't even admit it. I'm so embarrassed by it. You got to address it. Now, I'm going to give you some suggestions over here in this third column. But before I do, let me just say this real quick. If you're not a Christian, I have, and you already know this, but I just want to make sure you know that I know. I have no right in the world to tell you what to do. And just because Jesus said something doesn't mean you're obligated to do it. You've never signed on as a Jesus follower, so I get that. So if in the midst of this, you feel like I'm shaking my finger saying you need to, I'm really not. For those of us who signed on as Jesus followers, this isn't optional. This is what it means to follow Jesus. I mean, this is 101, but let me just say one more thing. If you're not a Christian or you're coming back or you're considering it, what we're about to talk about in the next 5.5 minutes is why following Jesus will make your life better and it will make you better at life. Even if you haven't come to the point and never come to the point that you can acknowledge that Jesus is who Jesus claimed he was, following Jesus, the way we're about to talk about, this is why we say following Jesus makes your life better and will make you better at life. It'll make you a better husband or wife or boyfriend or girlfriend or just friend or employee or employer. It'll just make you a better person. That's why Jesus' invitation was, follow me, follow me, follow me. And I'm going to ask you to do things that don't necessarily make any sense emotionally, but at the end of the day, at the end of the decision, you will experience a freedom and a peace that perhaps you've never, ever experienced before. So these are 4 preventative, in a way, heart exercises to keep you out of a ditch, to keep you from going outside the rails. And as I said, they are precisely the opposite of what we feel like doing or want to do. So what do we do with our guilt? These are just four words, is we confess. And not to God. Look up here. He already knows. When you confess to God, God doesn't go, what? Hey, somebody come here. You're not keeping me up to date on what's going on. Well, I had no idea. I'm so sorry. So sorry. Let me write that down. Okay, you did what? Now go slow, because I was paying attention. But this is what you were raised to do. You were raised, oh, come on, you were either raised to tell someone you barely know and never see in your real life, or you were told to tell God. The confession that heals and the confession that deals with guilt has to do with confession to somebody who is in your life, and ultimately to confess to the person that you hurt and that you stole something from. And it will damage your reputation. That's what guardrails do, minimal damage. It will hopefully temporarily maybe damage your marriage or your relationship with your fiance or your boyfriend. But if it's temporary, then it's minimal damage. That's the nature of a guardrail. It's minimal damage. But the longer you carry that guilt, the longer it eats you up inside and is going to drive you to other behaviors that eventually you're going to either have to confess or somebody's going to find out. Come on. Secrets suck the life out of you. And secrets suck the passion and the life out of a relationship. So if you were God and you loved you the way God loves you, what do you think you would say? You would say, come on, let's get rid of that. I want you to confess. And yeah, you're going to have to swallow your pride. But come on, your pride is why you did what you did to begin with. Confess it. And if you don't think you're ready to confess to the person you actually hurt, because that's too big of a step, then I would beg you, confess it to someone who is in your life. A trusted friend, somebody in your group, somebody at work, somebody that they're not a counselor. They're not going to try to fix it for you. But you need to get it out. And when you get it out and can look at it, chances are you'll take that next step. And eventually you will confess to the person that you hurt. And when you do, look up here. This is important. There will be a measure of chaos out here, but there will be a level and a measure of peace in here. And this will eventually dissipate. And this will eventually be something you work through. But you will have set yourself up for future success by simply doing the difficult work of confessing. Anger, we already know the answer to this. It's forgive. Do you know what forgiveness is? Forgiveness is identifying specifically what was taken from me and deciding you don't owe me anymore. It's not enough to say I had a terrible dad or I had a terrible mom or my boss. Okay, they were terrible, granted. But what did they take from you? What specifically was taken from you? You've got to identify specifically what was taken from you, and then you have to look at it and say, I'm making a decision. You don't owe me this anymore. I'm canceling the debt. That's what forgiveness is. It's canceling a debt, to which we say, I feel like I'm letting them off. You are. That's why I feel so bad. But you're letting somebody else off as well. You. Because you're digging up all of this out of your heart and you're saying, I will not be ruled by this anymore. It's not going to follow me into my next relationship. It's not going to follow me into my next marriage. It's not going to impact the way I discipline my kids. I'm done. I am deciding you don't owe me. You are forgiven. And what do? About greed? We give. We give. We write some big to you checks. You know what a big to you check is? It's a check that's big to you. May not be big to me, may not be big to the person up behind you, but to you, it's a big check. It may be a huge check compared to me, but to you, it's just a big check. You write some big to you checks. You decide, you know what, greed, you're not controlling me anymore. Watch this, I'm writing a check and I'm giving it to this nonprofit. Nah, nah, nah. And they didn't even ask. Ha, 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 you don't control me anymore. If you want to get serious, find something precious. An object, not a child, okay? Find something. You find something precious, like don't touch that, don't go in there, don't get your hands on that. You know, we keep it behind glass and you sell it and you give the money away. And you go, aha, these objects will not control me anymore. I'm not about stuff that somebody else is gonna have to sell. And I'm not against having stuff and I'm not against collecting stuff. But when it becomes the priority over people, you have a greed problem. And you can't continue to be consumed by what isn't even yours to consume. Christians don't trust in riches. We trust in Him who richly provides. Now, jealousy, we said that, you know, life owes me. But if you want to deal with jealousy, you've got to be willing to admit what the real problem is. And it's not that life owes you. At the end of the day, if you're honest, you believe God owes you. This is an issue not between you and your sister-in-law, because she married well, or because she has something, or because she, you know, whatever it was you wanted, now she has it, or your brother-in-law, or your roommate, because she's kind of moving on with her life, and you feel like you're in a cul-de-sac. It really has nothing to do with them. It has to do with what you think God owes you that God didn't give you. Because the truth is, see, life happens, but God takes what happens and makes things happen when we receive what comes our way from his hands and ask him to do with it whatever he pleases. I'll tell you where I've learned that lesson. I've learned that lesson watching Christians suffer. I have watched, as many of you have watched Christians go through things with family or children or illness or any kind of thing, financial thing, that they really didn't deserve, or just because of, just life happens. I mean, there's no explanation, just stuff happens. And instead of becoming bitter, and instead of spending the rest of their life comparing their bad fortune to everybody else's good fortune, somehow they just offer it to God, and they are the people I have the most respect for, and they are probably the people you have the most respect for. Why? Because they just don't compare. They just receive life from God and say, God, this is what happened. Now what can you do with what happened? The way you respond to jealousy is you begin to celebrate. You begin to celebrate what God has given you, and you begin to celebrate what God has given others. You begin to celebrate what God has given you, and you begin to celebrate out loud. Dear Frank, congratulations on the promotion. As you know, I was really hoping to get it, but I am genuinely happy for you. Love, and then you put in an envelope, and you say, jealousy, you do not live in my heart any longer. I am genuinely happy for you. You say, well, I don't feel it. It doesn't matter if you feel it. You are going to behave your way past these things that have the potential, come on, to pollute our heart and pollute our soul. Who has what you think you deserve? You need to figure out a way to celebrate them out loud. Now, for some of you, you need to do a little bit of some mirror work. You know what I mean? Mirror work is when you look in the mirror and you start talking to these things. Guilt. You're not living in my heart anymore. I'm confessing. Anger, you're not going to live in my heart anymore. I'm forgiving. Watch this. I'm going to forgive. In fact, I'm even going to write a list of all the things that were taken from me. I'm going to put an envelope and decide they don't owe me anymore. Because anger, you're not going to live in my heart anymore. I'm not carting you around from relationship to relationship to relationship to relationship. And greed, I'm going to write some big checks, okay? Greed, I'm going to be almost unhealthily generous until I can become a cheerful giver. Because see, some of you think you got to be cheerful before you give. That's not true. You give till you become cheerful. If you have to wait till you're cheerful, come on, you're never going to give. Because the cheerfulness of giving is the response to what happens when God opens your hands in your heart. You realize, you know what? I'm actually happier and I have more peace without it than I did clinging to it, protecting it, cleaning it, and ensuring it. So there's going to be so much cheer that follows. And then jealousy, you just look in the mirror and say, you know what? She or he or whoever they are, hey, you're not living in my heart anymore. I'm going to celebrate them. I'm going to look for opportunities all day long to celebrate their success. You are not my master. When my kids were little bitty, you know, last week I told you about the jars. You know, I gave them the three jars, and I just have always wanted, you know, to set my kids up for success. And because of what I do, because being a preacher's kid, I just see things sometimes a little bit differently. So early on, I wanted my kids, when they were little, to be able to learn to pay attention to what's going on the inside. Because when we raise kids, I mean, this is true for all of us when we were raised, you know, it's always behavior modification. Stand up, sit up, stand up straight, tell your mom, thank you, do this, do. It's behavior. And we did a lot of that, of course. But I wanted them to learn to identify what was going on the inside. So when I would put them to bed at night, I would just place my hand on their chest and I'd say, hey, Andrew, is everything okay in your heart? Anybody hurt your feelings today? Because sometimes kids don't know what to do. If it's hurt my feelings, I don't know what to do with that. Did anybody lie to you today? Andrew, do you feel guilty about anything? Did I break a promise? Sometimes parents break promise. But have I broken a promise? I'm just asking them all these questions. I just want to know, you know, what's going on the inside. I want them to learn to process this. So this goes on for year after year after year. Anybody hurt your feelings? Are you mad at anybody? All that stuff. So after years, one night I go to put Allie to bed and I say, Allie, is everything okay in your heart? Yes, Dad. I'm not mad at anybody. Nobody hurt my feelings. You didn't break a promise. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. I'm good. I'm like, good. Just checking. And you know what I thought? That's good. She knows the answer. She knows what to look for. She knows what to listen for. She knows what to feel for. So let me ask you this and we're done. Okay, come on. Is everything okay in your heart? 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 Are you mad at anybody? You've been having the same imaginary conversation with him or her for weeks. Is everything okay in your heart? Are you obsessed? Or there's something every time, in fact, it's hard to even listen today because there's something that just comes front and center and it just churns in your gut. Is everything okay in your heart? Clinging to anything that you know you have hurt some people's feelings over stuff. Have you recently, even in your heart, celebrated somebody else's failure? Celebrated the fact that life didn't work out for them the way you know they hoped it would work out for them? If so, that's dangerous. Because if it's in there, it's going to come out of there. And it will defile you with God. Not because God is squeamish, because God loves you and loves the people that your words and actions have the potential to hurt. So, above all else, guard your heart. For everything you do flows from it.